Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, there have been some contentious school board meetings in Wisconsin and beyond lately, often involving controversial issues. The authors of a new book say there needs to be more community involvement in schools. Find out why with the authors of The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. Now, another statewide air quality alert has been issued today as wildfires continue to rage in Canada. These wildfires are extreme. In British Columbia, the area burned is more than 5,000% the average amount. Nova Scotia, 4,000% more area than average. This is part of a long-term trend of fires becoming worse. The smoke and pollutants are drifting all the way down to Wisconsin and a lot of the eastern seaboard of the United States. As a result, we're under that statewide air quality alert. So what does that mean for our health? You could join in at 800-642-1234. How has the bad air quality impacted your life? Are you at a high risk? Do you have to be extra careful? Has the bad air quality over the last few weeks affected your health and your behavior? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Angela Tin is National Senior Director of the Clean Air Initiative for the American Lung Association. Angela, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we've been getting a lot of these air quality alerts in Wisconsin lately. Can you give us a sense of what we're seeing around the Midwest and around the country when it comes to the impact of this wildfire smoke?
Yes, around about 2.5 weeks ago, this all started, and we've been having high ozone and high particulate days in the Midwest, reaching down into the Florida area and especially out east.
When we have this current status, unhealthy for sensitive groups, that's our statewide alert right now. Who are we talking about there?
Originally, it started out sensitive groups, which are generally children who have a faster breathing rate and elderly people who have diminished lung capacity. However, it is unhealthy for all people right now.
When we see a warning like this, what do we do, particularly those people at higher risk? But what in general can we do to minimize our risk when we have these air quality alerts?
First off, you have to be knowledgeable, so you have to pay attention to these alerts, and you have to have a plan. A lot of the things you need to do is to go indoors, have all medications available, close the house, the doors up, have the air on a recirculating mode, have the air conditioner on, and generally have a plan for staying indoors during the episode.
For people who do want to get some time outside, I've seen suggestions that, okay, earlier in the morning tends to be the best time to do that when we've got air quality alerts. Is that generally true?
It is generally true, but because of the smoke, we're in a different situation. So you may have smoke any time of the day. So generally, normal warnings are not always accurate.
Talking to Angela Tin with the American Lung Association, looking at air quality, bad air quality with wildfire smoke and more. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Angela, of course, we have the wildfire smoke on our minds a lot right now. What are some of the other things that can contribute to bad air quality in communities?
What we have is a lot of situations where we have transportation sources, whether they're cars or trucks or railroads. A lot of the transportation sources and high heat causes excess ozone and particulate matter.
Have we seen improvements with things like the Clean Air Act? Are for these non-wildfire sources of bad air quality, have things gotten better at all over time?
Yes, as we look over time, and generally that's what we do is to look over time and see if there are improvements. And there have been downward trends in ozone levels in most of the United States, a little bit more trouble with the particulates, but we have been generally seeing downward trends. Although this summer, we're going to see lots of upward spikes.
Now, we worry on these bad air quality days about the acute impacts, again, particularly for people who are sensitive to those things. How about long-term exposure? What do we know about what this means for our health if we have consistently bad air quality?
Yes, there are short-term effects, there's long-term effects, and there are cumulative effects. And there's been a lot of studies on short-term effects, and we know how it affects us. And we know that even after 24 hours after the smoke dissipates, we still suffer short-term effects. Long-term effects, there's been a lot of studies, and there needs to be a lot more studies And definitely there will be some systemic effects.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Karen joins us in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. 2 weeks ago when the fire started, I was walking somewhere on the near east side of Madison and was short of breath. And I couldn't figure out why. I do have asthma, but don't really have to take meds for it. And then someone told me the air quality was terrible and that ozone was a problem. But I want to say more than that. I want to say what we need to do right now is stop what we're doing. You know, you're talking about the effect of smoke on human beings, like human beings are the pinnacle of life, and we cannot exist without this planet. We should have stopped this in 1960, and right now we should stop carbon emissions. We should talking like having fires that are so many thousand more acres than normal, quote unquote normal. Is something that we're going to deal with is just, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Gotcha. Karen, thanks for the call. We're going to look into some of the science with climate change and forest fires or wildfires in just a few minutes. But Angela, Karen's main point there that dealing with climate change might end up having a beneficial effect for our air quality. What do you think?
Yes, it will. And especially, you know, the causes of the wildfires, there's many different types of causes. Some of it is just through natural causes like storms and lightning. There could be accidental causes. There could be upkeeps of the forest land that they don't have enough protection. So certainly when the air is dry and the land is hot, there seems to be indicative of a lot more burns.
Thanks a lot for that call, Karen. And Karen mentioned also at the outset she has asthma, usually doesn't need medication to control it. Given that we're having air quality problems, this is a time for people with conditions like asthma to maybe rethink whether they need to have those inhalers around and other treatments.
Yes, they should always talk to their doctors, you know, before they make those kind of decisions. They should probably try to get indoors, but remember, smoke can get indoors too.
Thanks for the call, Karen. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I was watching a commercial broadcast TV station yesterday, and the meteorologist had said that the problem is not the smoke coming down from Canada. It's just a question of warm weather and the sunlight hitting ground level pollution, which is causing ozone. Which is it? And is it safe to go out for a healthy person to exercise?
Tom, thanks for the call. My understanding, Angela, is that we're under an ozone warning right now in Wisconsin, for example, but that wildfire smoke is part of the reason for that. Is that right?
Yes. Ozone and particulate matter. Remember, the smoke is the particulate matter. But what happens is that, there's also things burning, chemicals burning as part of the fires that could increase the amount of ozone. And yes, ozone is a normal consideration, especially when it's hot. But we haven't gotten into the heart of summer yet. And it's just a little bit early for the ozone season to be hitting full blast like it is now.
Tom, thanks for that call. And Angela, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today. That's Angela Tin, National Senior Director of the Clean Air Initiative for the American Lung Association. She joined us for a look at poor air quality and how it affects our health. Next, we'll find out why wildfires are so bad right now in Canada and how wildfire smoke gets all the way down to southern Wisconsin, and learn about efforts to predict when and where this kind of smoke will affect our health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about ongoing exposure to air pollution? What questions do you have? What policies would you like to see related to forest fires and air pollution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let us know, are you feeling this in your community, in your backyard? Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about Canadian wildfire smoke making its way to Wisconsin. We've got an air quality alert statewide today and through tomorrow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been affecting your life, your well-being, your decisions about whether and how to spend time outside in the last few days? Do you have questions about the chain of events from the wildfire to the smoke to the air in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Cheryl Magsiman is an associate professor of epidemiology at Colorado State University. Cheryl, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me.
Well, you've been studying this issue, Cheryl, looking at wildfire smoke, how it goes from the wildfires to our lungs, basically. Could you talk a little bit about the focus of your research lately?
Sure. So historically, I focused on traffic-related air pollution and things that we get from mobile sources, pollution we get from mobile sources and point sources in urban areas. But since living in Colorado, we are a state that is both impacted by local wildfires and wildfire smoke, as well as long-range transport from fires upwind in California and the Pacific Northwest. So it's a phenomenon that, unfortunately, I live with, and it's really important to us as the climate changes, not only in Colorado, but across the United States and across the world.
Now, I've lived in the Midwest for a goodly amount of time. Maybe we just didn't pay attention to it. I don't remember, you know, Western wildfire smoke being such a big issue here in the Midwest. Are things getting worse? Is this becoming more common?
Yes, unfortunately, things are getting worse. And a lot of that has to do with the drought that we're experiencing in the western part of the United States. As drought continues, the biomass, so trees, grasslands, areas get drier and are more likely to burn, which produces larger wildfires. And that smoke can be transported long distances across the U.S.
Is climate change part of this story?
Climate change is definitely part of this story, but part of the story with wildland fires is also being responsible, that we know that there have been several events also where these fires are caused accidentally by human activity. And knowing that our lands are so dry, especially in the western United States at this point, as Angela mentioned, that many of these fires are caused by natural causes like storms and lightning, but a lot of these fires are caused accidentally as well. So we need to be careful with our environment and make sure that we are behaving, knowing that we're living in a drier and drier climate.
Now, there in Colorado, as you mentioned, you've got very potentially local sources of smoke. How do we predict where and when a smoke from a wildfire hundreds, maybe thousands of miles away is going to come down to ground level and affect our air quality?
It's a great question, and it's awfully hard to predict because smoke depends on so many things: the size of the fire, the heat and intensity of the fire, as well as the meteorologic conditions that generate that smoke, how high into the atmosphere the smoke lofts, and how long it travels. So it's really hard to predict where the smoke's going to go. So what we ask people to do is to be air quality aware. And we think that this is especially more difficult for people in the Midwest, people living in Wisconsin, where there's not the fires that are associated with the smoke. So generally what we see in the Mountain West is a little more awareness, as well as the Western United States, because the emergency response that keeps people safe from fire also keeps people safe from smoke in terms of evacuation orders. But unfortunately, if you don't live near the fire, you may not be as aware that the smoke can travel a long distance and hit your communities. So we ask that people remain vigilant and checking the air quality. You can do that on a smartphone through your weather app. You can do that through the airnow.gov website and check what the air quality is. And there are instructions as to, if you are in some of the vulnerable groups, making sure that you stay safe, making sure that you have your medication with you, making sure that you check on your neighbors and friends to make sure that they're safe as well.
That's something that we left hanging from a caller in that previous segment. You know, for a healthy person, exercising outside, you've lived through this a lot more than we have in Wisconsin. What are the recommendations for if we should be out exercising when we have these air quality concerns?
It's really challenging because we know exercise is good for you. So we don't want to tell people not to exercise, but we also want to make sure that people are exercising in air that's not going to have a negative impact on their health. So what we say generally is that if you are managing a chronic disease, make sure to check that air quality, make sure to know, especially if it's an ozone event. I think what Angela suggested before, that ozone has distinguishable patterns where it tends to be higher during the warmer parts of the day. So getting out early to exercise is good. If it's a wildfire event, that smoke can be heavy at any time in the day. So we, again, try to encourage you to remain vigilant, try to encourage you to exercise, potentially doing something indoors, doing something that's lower intensity, and also listening to your body, making sure that, I know a previous caller had experienced symptoms. So it's really hard to try to balance that wanting to exercise and maintain your cardiovascular fitness with knowing that the air quality can potentially be harmful.
Now let's talk about that particulate and ozone issue. We measure both. Wildfire smoke can obviously give us that smoke and the particulate matter, but it also can be a precursor to higher ozone levels. Do I have that right?
You have that absolutely correct, where ozone is a secondary pollutant, meaning that PM2.5, refined particulate matter, is a combustion byproduct. So anything we burn creates these fine particles that can be inhaled deeply into the lungs. Ozone forms as a result of volatile organic compounds, heat, and sunlight that can all interact and create this ozone, which we know exacerbates asthma and other chronic lung diseases. So wildfires can generate both. The PM is directly associated with the burning, and the ozone is a secondary pollutant that comes downwind of the wildfires.
Does a hotter, sunnier day make that ozone production more likely?
Unfortunately, yes. That's why summertime ozone is such a big concern. And, you know, all the wonderful days of sunshine that we get in Colorado actually makes us more vulnerable to high ozone levels, and being downwind of high pollution areas like California, as well as areas in the Front Range where we get that volatile organic compounds, nitrogen dioxide interacting with heat and light to produce ozone. So unfortunately, having a nice, hot, sunny summer does increase ozone levels.
Talking to Cheryl Maxim, an associate professor of epidemiology at Colorado State University, looking at wildfire smoke coming here to Wisconsin and lots of other places too, raising air quality concerns, the health impacts of that. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cheryl, you mentioned, you know, if you're close to a wildfire, you have an evacuation maybe that gets you away from the smoke. Further away, okay, maybe we stay indoors where we've got higher smoke or ozone levels. I mean, are there societal adaptations? Are there ways we can build our communities differently to protect us from the smoke of the future?
You know, Rob, it's a great question, and it really is changing the air pollution paradigm. So previously, when we think about controlling air pollution, it's at the source level. So we put catalytic converters on cars, or we put scrubbers on smokestacks. And wildfire smoke is really changing how we think about controlling, where those controls really have to be at the receptor, which means us. We, you know, people, our communities, where now those changes have to largely be behavioral in terms of checking the air quality, potentially staying inside, potentially designing our buildings differently, where it's generally been thought that bringing in outdoor air inside has been beneficial. But if you're living in a wildfire-prone area or wildfire smoke-prone area, making sure that that outdoor air that's coming inside has been cleaned and filtered so you're not getting smoke particulates is something we need to think about more. I think COVID-19 has really forced us to think a little more critically about indoor air quality. And now with wildfire smoke, we're thinking about that even more so.
We have a caller who couldn't stay on the line, Cheryl, who's wondering and worried maybe about the emotional impacts of this. You know, this is the air we breathe, and we can't necessarily trust it in a situation like this. Some places have the weird, eerie landscape. We've seen that from San Francisco to New York City and points in between. Is that something you hear from people about?
Absolutely. And having a smoke episode, a severe one, is a climate disaster and an environmental disaster. And we usually don't think about air quality events being like that. It was so, I would say, in the earlier part of the century, before the Clean Air Act was implemented, that was usually associated with industrial pollution, as well as weather events like inversions. But now those eerie skies do take a mental health toll, just like any other disaster would. So there are groups now, especially at the federal level, who are working to understand how we adapt to this, not only from a physical sense, but from a mental health sense as well.
Now, on a practical level, we've got this smoke from way out west. What the smoke obviously went up high in the air for a long time and then came down. What determines where it touches down at the ground level where we actually breathe it?
That's a really hard question. It has to do a lot with meteorology, as well as kind of this weight, you know, of these particles kind of and their gravitational pull down towards Earth. So it's really challenging to predict where the smoke's going to go and where it's going to land. But eventually it lands somewhere. And that's, again, why we're trying to ask people to be vigilant, about checking the air quality and making sure that they have a plan in case poor air quality reaches their community, even from smoke events that are, you know, thousands of miles upwind.
Now, unfortunately, it seems like this is maybe a new normal. What are some of the big questions you and your colleagues are still working on, Cheryl, to understand, you know, the links between wildfire smoke and our health?
So there are really interesting and novel research questions, because the smoke events, as we experience, are really these large blasts of PM2.5 and other pollutants that can last anywhere from a short amount of time to weeks. And really, the way we understand how pollution impacts our bodies are from more background sources, like mobile sources like cars and trucks. So we have completely different exposure patterns when we're thinking about smoke. And we also have different adaptation patterns. For example, if there's a really bad smoke day, as you all are experiencing, you know, we don't understand what happens potentially if someone goes inside and what their air quality inside indoors is versus outdoors. So there's a lot we don't understand yet about this mitigation behavior. So how people are adapting to this new normal, as you said, that's what we call it as well. In addition, there's some questions and concerns about how toxic the particles are. So for example, in fresh smoke, if you're near a wildfire, there's some questions about the particles potentially being less toxic than as they travel through the atmosphere and age. However, there are other compounds that are emitted with wildfires that may cause greater amounts of toxicity closer to the wildfire rather than downwind. So there's many questions about the chemical constituents in the wildfire, how we're exposed to them, the length and duration, as well as how we behave when we're exposed to wildfire smoke in our communities.
Cheryl, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Cheryl Magsiman is an associate professor of epidemiology at Colorado State University. She talked to us about the air pollution resulting from ongoing Canadian wildfires. Still time for you to give us a backyard atmosphere report. What are you seeing? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Public schools have been the center of heated public debate in recent years. There's been a backlash against school COVID policies, arguments in the political world and in school board meetings about how schools handle issues of race and gender, and concerns about post-COVID declines in some nationwide testing scores. It can be easy to feel pessimistic about education, but our next guest sees something else, opportunity. They say it's a good time for school leaders and other stakeholders to embrace fundamental changes, connect with their communities, and turn to local democracy to solve these problems. And in their new book, they have lots of examples to share. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent or community member, have you had an opportunity to work with your school district? Was there a good line of communication? If you work in schools, are you looking for ways to connect with your local community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Landon Mascareñas and Donnie Tran are longtime educators, founders of the Open System Institute, and their new book is called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. Donnie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
And Landon, thanks for being with us.
Wonderful to hear you and be with you.
Landon, start us off with a big picture. What do the two of you mean by an open system as it applies to schools?
Well, first off, thanks for having us. And fundamentally, the big idea is that for too long in our nation's education systems, and actually in public systems generally, they have been closed off from the communities they serve, which means they have not been designed by the communities that surround them, whether that's because they were built in the past or because the population or community has shifted over time. We need to build more adaptive, interactive, and public systems, including our education system, that take in the information, work with stakeholders, family, parents, community members, business, to reimagine what's possible, and through that become open to co-creation and co-design with their community.
Donnie, the two of you have worked with districts around the country, particularly in Colorado, but elsewhere as well. How does this start? If a school leader is hearing this and saying, okay, this sounds good, sure, of course I want to engage with my community, where do they start?
Well, we think about trying to identify what we call an open moment, an opportunity to do the kinds of co-creation that Landon was just talking about with the community. And so the first step is really trying to identify what is that thing that both the leaders within the system and, you know, organizations like the board and the public, where can we agree that co-creation can be used to the highest and best effect? And so the thing that we recommend first is find that, and then really assemble an unusually diverse and inclusive group of community members and frontline educators and young people to really train their attention and energy to that problem.
Landon, I could imagine somebody on a school board or say an administrator saying, well, hey, I try to have a public meeting on blank, or we invite people to the school board meetings, but nobody shows up unless there's something really controversial, then everybody shows up and yells at us. What's the starting point for having, bringing people on board, as Donnie was just saying, and having productive, collaborative meetings?
Well, you know, you brought this up earlier in the introduction, but, you know, our public education system, like so much else in our democracy, is really undergoing a stress test to see if it can actually respond to the increased demands of the communities and parents and families they're a part of. But we really believe it's muscle building. It's about finding that moment and then actually building up on top of it, whether that's in a rural community in Colorado, thinking about how to build an economic development strategy, or in Kentucky to think about the way learning and assessment gets reimagined, or school discipline questions. These are political decisions that create opportunities for consensus building and working together. We have to admit that the way that too often this happens in both our public setting, but in education, are broken. The way we do task forces and committees aren't effective. And a big part of the book is building a shared discipline recommendations on how to do that effectively so that progress can occur.
Donnie, how can a school reach out to a community that hasn't been at the table as much, whether that's maybe a new immigrant community or a religious minority that feels excluded? How do you start to build those bridges?
Yeah, well, what we have found is that really intentional outreach with a very clear ask and a defined timeline helps people see their own role in the work, and to understand that it's not an open-ended commitment that's going to last forever. They understand the thing they're going to do in service of the system. So I'd say that first of all, and then really making thoughtful and culturally appropriate outreach, both through translated materials, is a critically important thing to do. And then also there are always folks in the community who are trusted brokers and trusted intermediaries between the system and different communities. And so conceptualizing, we are all in this together, and really identifying those folks who can build those bridges, and making sure that they understand the task at hand and understand that you are coming into this with a true co-creation ethos in place, really can help engender the kind of trust that allows these relationships to be built.
Talking to Donnie Tran and Landon Mascarenhas, we're talking about their new book, The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you're hearing? Is your experience with the school district, whether you're a parent, a student, or you work with the schools, does it sound like what they're talking about? Or does it sound like there's a barrier between the people running the schools and the rest of the community? Have you found ways to bridge that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm hoping each of you can give us one example of this kind of work in action. You've mentioned doing work in rural and urban communities. Landon, let's start with you. Give us a little bit of a case study that illustrates some of the points you've been making.
Well, one of the book is organized into a set of six principles that are each organized, again, around a case study or a vignette. And the first chapter is about open leadership, which is the idea that leaders in our education system have to act as democratic leaders. I mean, too often in our education management text, our training, we teach education leaders and a lot of public system leaders to be top-down folks that say, this is my way, and I have to rally people to this vision I have. And instead, we bring a lot of other types of ideas into that. And the case study that we showcase is a project I got to work on with a lot of really incredible people around Colorado called the Homegrown Talent Initiative, which had 8 communities that said, we want to think differently about bringing business, community partners, students, and parents and families and higher ed to the table to imagine a vision for rural economic development in our community. And through that, built internships and projects and new relationships with business that actually in many of these rural communities had atrophied and they had felt very isolated from each other. And in many of these places, there was a new spirit of kind of democratic connection and possibility. And we believe that's a critical aspect to what makes this work happen.
And Donnie, another case study in the book is in Denver as an example of what an urban environment might do with an open system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The really powerful story there, I see it from the perspective of the school leader that we got to know, who said to us, like, this is not really my school, and this is not my vision. This is the community's school and the community's vision. It's just my job to execute on that. And so he built, it was part of an initiative called the Year Zero Turnaround Project, where instead of, you know, the traditional turnaround models that are used, he spent an entire year really engaging with the community, building trust, building shared vision, and then executing on it. And what he found was that he actually unlocked a lot of capacity and energy from engaging the community in this way. I mean, sometimes we joke that surveys and focus groups are sort of unequal to the task of deep buy-in creation and the kind of buy-in that co-creation can really engender. And so what we saw in Drew's case study in Valverde Elementary was that really co-creating with his community brought families and their energy and their expertise with their young people into the school space.
We're talking to Donnie Tran and Landon Mascarenhas about their new book. It's called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. They say schools can find success by reaching out to their local communities, bringing the public on board as much as possible. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see opportunities for your local school district to connect with the community, do some of the things our guests are talking about? Is there an issue in your local school that you think has been handled well or poorly? Do you feel like there's good communication between the community and the school district, or bad communication? Do you have a question for our guests about how all of this could work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Landon Mascarenhas and Donnie Tran about their new book. It's called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. They're making the case that school leaders should reach out to their local communities and harness the power of local democracy to create a better education system. Still time for you to join in if you have experience trying to solve a problem with a school, whether that's as a parent or community member or a teacher or administrator. Love to hear how things worked and didn't work in that situation and your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Landon, one key idea I think underlying a lot of this is the solution for school A that a community comes up with might be very different from the solutions that community B comes up with, and that's okay.
That's totally right, Rob. You know, actually, a big part of the challenge that we've seen in a variety of education initiatives that have come across this country and around the world have really struggled with this idea of we have to replicate and scale and replicate and scale and this compulsion for copy-paste. But the reality is that the solutions have to be tailored in a hyper-local way. That Homegrown Talent Initiative I talked about earlier, 8 communities all over rural Colorado. Each community came up with their own vision of what a graduate should actually achieve. Different words, different visions, different possibilities, different types of the way they wanted to make it manifest. And those hyper-local solutions have to be co-created at the local level, not only to create legitimacy and buy-in, but to actually tailor them to the unique features of that community.
Donnie, I could see somebody at a school district saying, yeah, that sounds great, but the state is going to test all my kids X number of times a year. We have to meet their standards, and there might be federal standards we have to meet. And if the solution our community comes up with, you know, works on some standards but doesn't help, you know, with those test scores, well, we kind of lose in some ways. Is that a problem?
Yeah, I think we need to embrace some both and thinking on this, that what we are talking about is really unlocking the capacity of parents to be partners in school and to be partners in their young people's success. And there's going to always be times when the things that they want are going to be a little bit orthogonal or a little tangential to what the ways in which schools are assessed. But oftentimes parents and schools deeply want the same thing. When they get on the same page about it, it's a powerful lever for really improving the kinds of outcomes that we want for all of our children. And those, and also at the same time they're doing that, they can dive more deeply into the things that make their communities unique and use those as lenses to really engage with all academic content. So we see it as a both and.
Landon, one concern that nags at me is, you know, parents have kids, they often have jobs, their schedules are busy. How could people try to convene these kind of open system schools make sure they include people who don't have a lot of time necessarily to participate?
It's a really good question. I mean, fundamentally, this is a big dilemma in the family engagement community partnership space, is how do you create conditions for spaces to be created where there's equitable access for all individuals? When I was at Denver Public Schools helping to run the family engagement office, this was a major concern of us. You know, we had to provide translation and schedule things at appropriate times. You know, I never would have said it before the pandemic, but I've come to believe that virtual meetings are a major part of the solution. They create enormous amounts more access, especially across geographical areas. You can call different types of conversations into existence. Parents don't have to find childcare for their kids. They can Zoom in. It also reduces some of the affinity barriers that we see show up when we create spaces like this, where everyone who knows together hangs out together and has the pre-meeting and the side meeting. And so I think that there are some really interesting solutions that the pandemic has offered to us in these moments. And one of the things that we talk a lot about in the book, Rob, is that we have to disrupt the traditional way that we think about building these spaces. It can't just be one place on a website to have an application to get on, and only the people that have time and energy to get on make it. The school districts have to think about random selection, inviting new people into the process, bringing social capital leaders in the community through direct invitation. That's a part of the design as well, is that we have to think bigger and broadly about the way we practice inclusive democracy.
Donnie, I want to get something back to something Landon mentioned earlier about kind of changing the idea of what it means to be a leader at schools in the first place, from the idea of I have this vision that I'm going to implement and I'm going to try to get buy-in for it, hopefully, but I'm going to do things my way, to becoming a leader in the sense of let's find out what people want to be led to in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. That was very well said. That what we see is many people who are in education shy away and say things like, oh, I don't like the politics. I don't like doing politics. And I think that really is a narrow view of what we even mean by that word and what we mean by the act of public leadership. And we really do think that principals and superintendents and state commissioners are all public leaders. And we think of this act of leadership within an open frame is, how do I deeply understand and empathize what we collectively want and need to feel whole and successful? And then how do we bring our collective energy to bear to make that a reality? And it doesn't mean that a leader comes in with no opinion and does whatever the community wants. It means that they create a space for deliberation, dialogue, and different kinds of expertise to come together and truly form something that is shared between all of its participants.
Talking to Donnie Tran and Landon Mascarenhas about their new book, The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. Landon, obviously the target audience, I think, for your book is for people who are in those school leadership positions or work in schools. But how about if there's somebody out there listening, maybe a parent or concerned member of their community saying, this sounds great. I would love to see more of this in my district. What can everyday people do to try to work with their schools to at least experiment with these open system concepts?
You know, Rob, when we were writing the book, we were really intentional to say that there's two audiences for the book. There is the education leaders that we're talking about right now, the principals, the superintendents, the commissioners, the teachers. But we really intentionally also design it for folks outside of the system, the community organizer, the parent, the activist. And we really said that the part of the dilemma is that these two groups of people, in fact, across all of those different stakeholder groups, don't have a shared language. And that a big part of our idea was to create a shared discipline so that when they are working together, when their values are actually aligned and they're trying to do this work and they want to get started, they can start having big moves together or small moves together that they can use together, use a similar language. And it's a part of the reason we use the term open. It's not a complicated word in the discourse. You know, when we would line up a bunch of educators or parents and say, what does family engagement mean to you? You get a, you know, 100 different answers. When we talk about openness, it conjures up something deep inside of us. We understand that at a more fundamental level. And I think when we've worked with parents and educators in conversations like this, they can start to identify simple, clear moves, whether it's the way that home visits can occur, the way an after-school program can be available, the way that a diploma can be more accessible and online, that both parties can come to the same space around.
And one big point there, Donnie, that Landon reminds me of is you're not making the case that an administrator should completely overhaul their school district between now and opening day at the end of summer. People could start small. What can you give some more examples of the kind of small projects that people could work to implement these open system ideas on?
Yeah, absolutely. We never try to fool people into thinking that open system work is easy. First of all, it is powerful and deeply fulfilling, but it is a challenge to be the container and the heart and one who harnesses and cultivates all of this energy. And so we do recommend that people look very carefully at the system that they're in and ask themselves, like, what is the thing that is the right bite size at this moment? And given my capacity and the energy and trust within my community. And so it can be anything from, you know, as Landon mentioned before, school discipline policies or something as ambitious as grading policy. Okay, that's not a beginner move. I just want to be clear about that. But it could be also something small in terms of, well, how might I co-create, you know, a family night the process for, you know, doing something operational at the school so that it feels like there you can build a little bit of muscle around how to engage your community in a deep way.
Landon, in just the last half minute or so, you've been making the case for the open system for a while. Are people buying what you're selling? Are these ideas catching on?
You know, one of the reasons we're really excited about this book coming out, Rob, is that we have stories from all over the country, Georgia, Kentucky, Chicago, Colorado, New Mexico. There is a hunger in our country right now, we believe, coming out of COVID because of the democratic stress test we're under. There is a hunger and a desire for more involvement in our schools. And the answer can't just be, it's too much. We have to say, if public education is the forge of our democracy, we have to open up to let people in. And we have been inspired by people from around the country taking on that charge because they believe deeply in the future of what education is possible when we all work together.
Thanks to both of our guests today. We've been talking to Landon Mascarenhas and Donnie Tran. Their new book is called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, airline passengers would get more compensation when flights are canceled under a proposed federal rule. Find out what's in the works and get a look at the state of air travel. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin cook helps us make the most of the farmers market and local produce section during the summer. And you can join in and share some of your favorite sightings at that local market. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll get an update on chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin's deer herd, how it's been managed by hunters in the DNR, as well as a study that shows a new possibility for how the disease might spread. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.